Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
All right. Well, welcome back, folks. And it is now or never. And, you know, I hope you understand that this show is not to entertain you, and this show is not to inform you of all the little bad things that are happening. You know, our liberties are at full level assault. As a matter of fact, we are under a broad spectrum warfare attack that we are being set up. What's going on the world stage is, you know, left, even the national stage and the local stage, we try to leave for Feedback Friday. So for those that want to talk about the issues, please tune in on Feedback Friday. And as a matter of fact, if you want to hear something very specific, then you need to just say, hey, would you please talk about, you know, this myopic issue of gun control, what have you? And I only say that because if you don't give me feedback of what you really want to have some constitutional context to on Feedback Friday, then you give me the option to start going down a lot of different paths. Now, some things need to be said. And so the game changer, the special episodes that we're doing right now on Mondays is something that absolutely needs to be said because we need to connect all the dots regarding this broad spectrum warfare. You know, it's easy for somebody to say, we're under attack. You know, the wolf is coming, the wolf, you know, fire, whatever you want to make Chicken Little say. You know, Chicken Little can be out there saying, you know, these terrible things. But if you don't have evidence, if you don't see smoke, you don't, you know, see the light in the horizon at nighttime, then the idea is fire really, you know, over there? Because there are signs and evidence that can be provided. We have all the evidence necessary to prove this broad spectrum warfare. And so this is one of the reasons why we go through the Constitution and how it was defined. This is why it is so important, because when the law protects us from a very specific type of government, and government actually is doing things that is outside their authority, then how do you view that as anything other than not just a violation, but actually warfare against the law itself? It's an insurrection. When we start connecting the dots, it starts making sense. And, you know, it's really so simple, folks. The Constitution and the demand, the legal law in demanding within the Constitution that it is the supreme law, that we have to follow it. If we just did that, most all of our problems go away. So why worry about what they're doing? Let's just demand and force them into compliance. And the only way to do that is you have to understand what those things are, what they're supposed to do, what they can't do, and make them do those things that they can do and stop them from doing the things that they can't. It really is that simple. And we have Paul Venable with us, so sorry for holding you up, Paul. But doesn't that make sense?
No problem, GR. Thanks. And yes, it makes complete sense. And what I've discovered is that it makes sense to audiences as well. Everybody doesn't get it right away, but some people do. And when the light turns on, then it's kind of amazing to watch.
Yeah, I love, you know, seeing that light bulb, the metaphorical light bulb in their mind, you know, all of a sudden start shining because their eyes kind of open up and all of a sudden their head, you know, it's, everybody has seen a dog. When a dog is trying to figure out what the heck you're doing, they'll tilt their head. And people do the same thing. And people actually react when they hear you saying things. And what is this? So anyway, any saved rounds? Because, again, you know, when we do these things, we kind of, you know, end abruptly on what we're covering as far as content goes. And we just started covering the Massachusetts debates. Anything you want to add or anything we need to dive into?
Oh, I don't know. I think we should just go ahead and get started. We're on Monday, January the 14th, right?
That is correct. As a matter of fact, the reason, so I kind of skimmed over the proceedings in electing John Hancock and all of that. And so at this point in time, they're kind of going through some very specific things. And there's things that I think are really important that I talk about that are brought up right here. And so if you would placate me and kind of go through these proceedings of what they're doing and what they need. It's just basically the first page here. But if you could, just go ahead and let's pick this up, and then we'll kind of cover it after you cover it. Okay.
Sure. Let's do that. January 14th. The Constitution for the United States of America, as reported by the Convention of Delegates held at Philadelphia in May last, together with the resolutions of the General Court of this Commonwealth for calling a convention, agreeably to the recommendation of Congress, were ordered to be read. On motion of Mr. Strong, voted that this convention, sensible how important it is that the great subject submitted to their determination should be discussed and considered with moderation, candor, and deliberation, will enter into a free conversation on the several parts thereof by paragraphs until every member shall have had an opportunity to express his sentiments on the same, after which the convention will consider and debate at large the question whether this convention will adopt and ratify the proposed constitution before any vote is taken expressive of the sense of the convention upon the whole or any part thereof. The resolve of the General Court of this Commonwealth of March 1787, appointing delegates for the Convention of the States held at Philadelphia, was ordered to be read. A motion was made and passed that the Honorable Eldridge Gerry be requested to take a seat in the convention to answer any questions of fact from time to time the convention may ask respecting the passing of the Constitution. Afternoon, ordered that a committee of three be appointed to wait upon the Honorable Eldridge Gerry and acquaint him with the vote of this morning, requesting him to take a seat in the convention to answer to any questions of fact from time to time that the convention may ask respecting the passing of the Constitution. Agreeably to the resolution passed in the forenoon, the convention proceeded to consider the first section of the Constitution and, after a short conversation, entered upon the discussion of the second section, the first paragraph of which caused a lengthy debate. The convention entered upon the consideration of the proposed Constitution and, having debated thereon through the day, postponed the further consideration thereof to the next morning. It had been mentioned by some gentlemen that the introduction of tyranny into several nations had been by lengthening the duration of their parliaments or legislative bodies, and the fate of those nations was urged as a caution against lengthening the period for which Congress is to be chosen.
Okay, thank you. And so let me point out a couple of things. They really brushed over what has happened. This was a kind of a highlight of everything that has happened from the beginning of the convention that started on the 9th of January. And this is the beginning of the real debates, the ratification debates on the 14th. So in other words, they spend a lot of time, you know, picking out leaders and all of that. But there were other things that they did. And the one part that is right in the very first paragraph, it's the last line in the paragraph, agreeable to the recommendation of Congress, were ordered to be read. In other words, this Constitution, and I'm just going to read this again. The Constitution for the United States of America, as reported by the Convention of Delegates held in Philadelphia in May last, together with the resolutions of the General Court of this Commonwealth for calling a convention, agreeable to the recommendation of Congress, were ordered to be read. In other words, there was an issue that they had to agree that they were going to actually read this Constitution and debate it. They don't say that in the details, but what they do say, if you really look at the high level, is that they had to verify, they had to ensure the veracity. Is this a legitimate document that they needed to spend the money and time of the body politic of Massachusetts in ratifying something? And if it was legitimate, they would ratify, they would, you know, debate it and ratify it. If it was not legitimate, then they weren't going to debate it. And they would have dismissed, and they basically would have sent a resolution back to Congress saying that this was not a legitimate document, blah, blah, blah. They exceeded their commission. All of the things that the anti-federalists were pursuing.
Okay.
So I've
got a question.
Go ahead.
When you get a chance. Okay. So there are multiple references to Eldridge Gerry.
Yes.
And as if he is a witness.
Yes.
Eldridge Gerry wasn't one of the signers of the Constitution.
That's why. See, here's the interesting thing. It was overwhelmingly supported. This Constitution was overwhelmingly supported. And so Eldridge Gerry, because he refused to sign it, was not elected as a delegate to the ratification debates. One would think that all men that were involved in the debates would have at least became to actually testify. The reason you see this, it was the anti-federalists that wanted him to be there, but their own people of Massachusetts chose not to put him in the convention because they didn't want to hear what he had to say, because at that point in time, they were already in the disposition of accepting this Constitution. And the anti-federalists were, you know, because you got to remember, this is January. Now, we've seen Delaware rubber stamp this. Pennsylvania was just coming out with their ratification and their recommendations and, you know, and so forth. And you know, news doesn't travel fast in these days, but and it's not thorough, because, you know, to commit to all of this content, it took a lot of time. Just writing of, you know, something took time. And anyway, so they were kind of, they already had their, you know, the elections, and they were already forming their opinions, and they, and the people of Massachusetts, the majority of the people, really wanted the Constitution to be ratified. The anti-federalists that were present came up with some very good arguments, so much so that it actually, John Hancock, who was an advocate for the Constitution, created the olive branch that really silenced the anti-federalists, or it changed enough of the sentiments to basically help the Constitution be ratified by Massachusetts by saying, we're going to not stipulate, but we're going to request that clearly this, if Congress is going to serve us, they will weigh our request with the weight that we send it in seeking these amendments to the Constitution. And so, I mean, John Hancock, because basically, you know, when you really look at it, who was in Congress? Congress was the makeup of the states. It was we the people. In other words, you know, they were going to send their own representation. The state legislature were going to send their representation to the Senate and so forth. I mean, it's not like they were turning things over to Britain. They were creating a whole new government that had different checks and balances that didn't exist in the current government. And so this was so superior in so many different ways, but the anti-federalists, because they saw that it was going to take away the powers of the states, the anti-federalists, the desire in maintaining its control over that state power was, you know, their driving factor. So they wanted to have Eldridge Gerry to come and to testify. The funny thing, and here's, if you really do the research, you'll find out that Eldridge Gerry showed up and then he went absent. He went AWOL. He only testified once or twice on a given day, but I don't think he came back after that, because if you read, it was amazing that Eldridge Gerry was actually elected into Congress, you know, after the Constitution was ratified. And that he had, the only way that he was able to get elected into Congress is he had to admit that he was wrong in not signing it. So, in other words, you know, it's that old saying, politics makes interesting bedfellows. Politics really Correct. Makes, you know, so when people take a stand on principle, sometimes they realize that their principle was more of a plank that they walked. You know, they walked their own plank, and they had to walk mm-hmm. back that plank, because had they kept walking, they would have been, you know, washed up. They would have been, you know, out in the cold. And Eldridge Gerry basically created a plank. He walked, and he had to successfully walk back that plank. I think James Madison, in a way, you know, I don't think he walked a plank. I think what he did was he said, okay, you know, it's not that we need a Bill of Rights, but the people want a Bill of Rights, and we need to frame a Bill of Rights in such a way that it does not empower the government. And that's why when you read the preamble of the Bill of Rights, it is contained with this, that these are declaratory reservations. These are not powers being enumerated. These are the enumerations of further declaratory clauses restricting the government, not giving them more power. And so anyway, you know, it's kind of this delicate balance. But yes, Eldridge Gerry, and oh, by the way, Eldridge Gerry is the father of gerrymandering. Because,
so that's where they got the name from.
Yes, but they mispronounce it, because when people right. started pronouncing it, they looked at, oh, it's gerrymandering, but it was actually pronounced Gerry.
Okay.
But when they saw that, this is gerrymandering, yes. But in the early days of the Constitution, Eldridge Gerry did, you know, do gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is what people call gerrymandering. But it was Patrick Henry who was the first, and he actually played this in the ratification debates and so forth. So what Eldridge Gerry did was he was just basically mimicking, and he got called out for it, and basically the court stepped in and said, hey, you're trying to create circumstances to benefit one party, you know, for political purposes, you know, in controlling government by marginalizing the influence of these people or what have you. And that's basically what gerrymandering is. But anyway.
Well, GR, let me ask you, I'm sorry, I don't want to take up.
No, it's okay.
I don't want to mess up the question, but let me take up this question for a minute, because gerrymandering or gerrymandering has been in the public discussion of late. And so maybe for the benefit of our audience, can we understand what it is and what is the right way to deal with it?
Well, so the reason representation can be manipulated is because it sits on, you know, a physical piece of land, and we have to draw boundaries around that. And so when you sit down and you draw boundaries, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when the county actually creates the boundaries of government, it's done by voting. In other words, when we look at the voting, what is the basic sub-element of our government politically?
At this point, I believe it's probably ought to be townships, but it's probably counties.
No. Actually, even because it gets down to voting. So think in the context of voting, and think in the context of party, because the party adapt. There you go. Precinct. So the precinct should never be divided. Once you've created a precinct, and the precinct is determined by how many voters. mm-hmm. And so as you basically say, okay, we cannot make a precinct. A precinct cannot exist more than so many voters. And so, you know, when you have a population that grows, then you subdivide that precinct. And as it grows, then you subdivide and subdivide. And that's why in the cities, you have, you know, very small precincts to where a city block could be, you know, two precincts.
Correct.
You know, if you have that many people in that area, is that many registered voters. And so that's how they divide it. And when you look at gerrymandering is, and as a matter of fact, in, let me pull it up because I want to use the guy's name because he's a radical and he is a progressive. And let me see here. I think this is, yes, this is what I want. Okay, so the guy's name that we need to change gerrymandering to should be Zwanitzer. Zwonitzer. Daniel Zwanitzer in Cheyenne, Wyoming. He basically, because he knew he was going to lose because they were doing the layout of apportionment because of the census. And this has actually come to me. And I'm really glad you asked this because this is really important. We now have the technology to make adjustments on apportionment, you know, on a yearly basis, if not every 2 years at a minimum. Instead of doing a national census and instead of allowing the federal government to spend the money and, you know, using this data collection manipulation of information, it's because the whole point of the census is for one purpose and one purpose alone. It is to determine apportionment. And so each state should actually have the power to basically say, hey, we have grown. If they have grown in magnitude that would take them over a representative, they should be able to seize representation. And the states that have lost representation should actually lose that seat.
Okay.
Instead of waiting every 10 years. Because the dynamics are changing. And what is happening is the democracies are growing in, you know, in South Dakota, in these states where people are leaving California. Well, correct. California is still driving because we know California has lost significant apportionment. I think they lost 11 seats in the last census. And but they're still losing seats and they should still be charged with losing seats every year that they lose seats. So at least every 2 years. And we have the ability to do this. So wherever those seats are to be gained, they need to be, okay, this state actually gained and they get it and California loses it.
So in other words, what you're saying is that we ought to be able to adjust apportionment in real time.
Right. We have the technology to be able to adjust apportionment every 2 years instead of every 10 years and actually be more accurate in our Republican form of government. Because if it's about a Republican form of government, we should be able to do these things. So this whole Eldridge Gerry and this gerrymandering basically it opens the door to allow us to actually start getting the proper representation because the red states are the states that gained representation.
So who is this Wanitzer? He doesn't even look old enough to have done whatever you're describing in
if you do the research, the research in redistricting and Zwanzer, he actually created gaps between precincts. In other words, his district had like, you know, this little teeny finger and then grabbed a bunch of people on one side of town and then had this one, like one precinct to one precinct to one precinct to another large body. In other words, if you look at it, it's almost like eyeglasses with a little bridge, but it's even worse than that. It's much worse than that. But hold on, Paul, because what we've got right now is our break, so we're going into a break. And so give me this promo and we come back. But so you could do the due diligence while we're on break so you can actually kind of look at how he did the redistricting for his district so he could maintain his position in office because he was becoming irrelevant. And he's a hardcore progressive. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so not sure if you actually could see it, but there were reports and there were articles where it was exposed of how he was manipulating a district that would actually keep him in office because he knew where his support was and he needed to make sure that they were maintained, and he created these bridges, if you kind of see what I'm saying.
Okay, well, you realize that Representative Zwanzer is still an active member of the Wyoming legislature.
Yes, because they actually challenged the way that district was done, and the court basically ignored it. So one of the problems, folks, that we have to all acknowledge is that the courts are a big part of the problem. They're huge contributors. As a matter of fact, every time I go, when we're doing, large campaigns and we have judges that are, constitutional judges that aren't getting appointed and or elected because it's all about the money and the influence. This is why we need to make all elections local and all these other things. But bottom line, the court is actually aiding and abetting all of this illicit corruption. And so when they see these types of things, they allow it to happen. And so when reasonable people, equally informed, they sit down and they look and they say, hold on here, you're creating a situation just strictly so that you can maintain your position in office. Because there was just no way he could have done it any other way other than capturing the people in these very specific sections or developments where the progressives were, And so as they did the reapportionment, he was called out. And, he's basically been, I don't want to say label lynched, but he's been appropriately assessed by the people as a tyrant. And, unfortunately, the only way to get rid of these people is through common law grand juries, common law courts, and using the Constitution. Because obviously this guy votes against the Constitution. He can be removed that way. There's all sorts of ways to get rid of these people, folks. And we have to use every single one of these tools. And it's these tools that will help us get rid of the courts themselves, because common law grand juries can remove justices. Anyway.
Well, thanks for – you covered a couple things.
Right.
We covered some background on Eldridge Gerry.
Yeah.
And then we took it a little further about what the purpose of –
of the apportionment.
The census.
Yeah, the census
and
so forth.
The purpose of the census for apportionment, because then you brought up some points that are really germane to today, to today's technology, to today's abilities that they didn't have back then. They had to have a census.
Right.
They had to count, and so that they could determine that, but because they didn't have the tools that we have now. So, wow, there are a lot of things we can look at because of the technology, because of the tools that we have today, that we could not have considered 250 years ago.
Right.
That's amazing. And so I'm glad we brought these points up.
Right.
If you're ready, we can go to the next thing, unless you've got...
Yeah, you know, absolutely. So the next thing we're going to read is under the subcategory of morally bankrupt. And currently, that whole part, you know, after reading the fourth section, should all be highlighted, but it's probably not all highlighted for you. So if you would just read from the morally bankrupt all the way through the highlighted part to General Porter. Now, this, folks, is January 16th. It's 2 days into the debates, and they're starting to cover some of these things that... And Massachusetts, because of its spirituality focus, because of their spiritual focus on law and the government and so forth, they actually looked at things that some of the other states didn't look into the same details, like this moral bankruptcy or this concept of Congress being able to pass laws and immune themselves from those types of things, because that's moral bankruptcy. That's moral turpitude. That is corruption. When our lawmakers inflict pain upon us and immune themselves from it. And so if you want to go ahead and just start off with, after reading the fourth section, go ahead.
So this is Mr. Pierce from Partridge Revealed, morally bankrupt.
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
After reading the fourth section, wished to know the opinion of gentlemen on it, as Congress appeared thereby to have a power to regulate a time, place, and manner of holding elections. In respect to the manner, said Mr. P, suppose the legislature of this state should prescribe that the choice of federal representatives should be in the same manner as that of governor, a majority of all the votes in the state being necessary to make it such, and Congress should deem it an improper manner, and should order that it be as practiced in several of the southern states where the highest number of votes make a choice. Have they not power by this section to do so? Again, as to the place, continues Mr. P, may not Congress direct that the election for Massachusetts shall be held in Boston? And if so, it is possible that previous to the election, a number of the electors may meet, agree upon the 8 delegates, and propose the same to a few towns in the vicinity who, agreeing in sentiment, may meet on the day of election and carry their list by a major vote. He did not, he said, say that this would be the case, but he wished to know if it was not a possible one. As the federal representatives who are to form the democratical part of the general government are to be a check on the representatives of the sovereignty, the Senate, he thought the utmost caution ought to be used to have their elections as free as possible. He observed that, as men have ever been fond of power, we must suppose they will continue so, and concluded by observing that our caution ought, in the present case, to be greater, as by the proposed Constitution, no qualification of property was required in a representative, and it might be in the power of some people thereby to choose a bankrupt for a representative, in order to give such representatives employment, or that he might make laws favorable to such a description of the people.
Okay, so this is kind of interesting because you actually got exposed to something, and I think that you would find this interesting because of your affiliation with the Constitution Party.
Okay.
You specifically, Paul, because they talk about the electors, and they talk about how the electors could actually function corruptly by choosing who they wanted for president. Now, the Constitution is really clear that it's a representative government. And who are the electors to represent?
They're to represent the people who elected them.
Then the people would then be the ones that would actually vote for the electors.
That's correct. That's the way
it's supposed to work.
I think it's the way it's prescribed, right?
Right. So, folks, in 2024, when the presidential election is going to start happening, and every state will start choosing who they're going to have for their president, I want you to understand that the presidential race is being trimmed and focused based on the party. In other words, it's not a true, open, and honest election.
Well, here's how it goes if I can share my experience.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
Because what the parties do, and let's say, for example, when the to be on the ballot, the parties need to find a certain number of electors in each congressional district. So, for example, the Constitution Party, we had to be involved in this, had to find people who were Constitution Party electors whose names would be on the ballot. Same for the Republican Party, same for the Democratic Party. If you're a party with ballot access, in each congressional district, you have to have a chosen elector for the Constitution Party, okay, and plus two at large,
okay,
for the senators.
So let me ask you this. So right now you're talking about Missouri.
I'm talking about Missouri. Well, okay, so in Idaho, we had to do the same thing there.
So in Idaho, in the primary election, did you actually see electors on the ballots, or did you see the candidates that you voted for?
You saw, this is what you saw, and it's been a while since I've been in Idaho. You saw the candidate that you voted for with their electors' names underneath. In other words, if you voted for the candidate, you got those electors. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I know in most states, because Washington and most of the states out there, they choose their electors during the way the party works, they choose their elector during the state convention. And the
correct,
and the state convention usually occurs a couple of months before the primary election.
Right.
And so sometimes they have caucuses and so forth. But bottom line, during the convention, the body of the party votes for the elector, and the elector is already assigned.
That's correct.
What the Constitution dictates is you, the people, are to choose who your elector is to be.
Correct.
And
so, right,
so you, yourself, if you really want to kick the hornet's nest and you really want to make all the people that are all the party loyalists in your county pissed off, challenge them to say, I want to be the elector for choosing of the president for this congressional district, and I want my name on the ballot, and I'm not affiliated to the parties at all. I will appropriately choose the most constitutional candidate and challenge the veracity of the party being able to actually put what that name is, because you don't get to choose your elector.
Correct. You don't. And the way it's designed is that the electors are chosen by whatever private club that is. It
right,
could be the Constitution Party. It could be the Republican
Party. But the Constitution
Party,
doesn't
the
allow that.
Party.
The Constitution demands that you choose your elector.
I love this, JR. Boy, am I going to make a stink.
Because technically, if we're a Republican form of government, because what is happening, folks, is a monarchical party form of democracy. We do not have a Republican form of government because you're not actually allowed to choose your elector.
Mm-hmm.
The monarchical party is choosing the elector for you because they are the ones that are anointing your next monarch. At the state level, it's your prince. At the national level, it is your king.
Mm-hmm.
and at your county level and your, you know, city level, you know, it's dukes and duchesses and counts and so forth. We right. have a monarchical party form of democracy, and the parties have co-opted full control. But the whole point is, and it's really clear here, is that the electors, he's talking about how the electors could collude together and they could choose who the president is at that point and create a ticket. And they were considering this morally bankrupt.
This is what we're doing.
And it is morally right. bankrupt because, folks, in a true, honest, and open Republican form of government based on the Constitution, you are to choose your elector. And so going through and how they discuss these points and parts in the Constitution just opens it up so that we can actually start seeing the truth. It's shining that light of truth in the dark recesses where evil tends to grow. Now, so the next part we're going to read, and we're going to jump down to page 26. And I need to do some other searches, so we may actually add some things, you know, we may have to jump back on, because I didn't get a chance to go through some recent searches for some very specific things that are, you know, of relevance for today. But let's go ahead and jump into this welfare comment. Now, so when we say moral, what was that one we had? Moral bankruptcy.
Morally bankrupt?
Yeah, and right. this is welfare. These are words I add that are kind of the headline of what's going to be covered in, you know, what they're talking about in the debates. So I just want you to know I'm not taking latitude. I'm just trying to kind of create and connect dots so that you, when we read this, you go, huh, okay. So go ahead, read the welfare part.
So this is Mr. King speaking on welfare.
Right.
Excuse me just a minute.
Yes.
I just needed to clear my throat.
That's okay. That's absolutely okay to say. So when you read this, you're going to be saying Rose to explain it. This actually, right. if you just said Mr. King rose to explain it, that's
okay.
So yeah. I just basically just brought it down and inserted welfare. So go ahead.
All right. So Mr. King rose to explain it. There has, says he, been much misconception of this section. It is a principle of this Constitution that representation and taxation should go hand in hand. This paragraph states that the number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons. These persons are the slaves. By this rule are representation and taxation to be appointed. And it is adopted because it was the language of all America. According to the Confederation ratified in 1781, the sums for the general welfare and defense should be apportioned according to the surveyed lands and improvements thereon in the several states. But that it hath never been in the power of Congress to follow that rule, the returns from the several states being so very imperfect.
Right.
GR, yeah. Help us understand what this is saying.
Okay, so first off, this is Rufus King that's speaking, Rufus King. And okay. So when we look at what he's really saying, he's kind of going into how the welfare clause, because technically when you're looking at the apportionment and when you're looking at the preamble of the Constitution, the general welfare clause and so forth, how it is to be administered, he talks about, you know, the apportionment and slaves and so forth. But more importantly, he talks about how, you know, the federal government is to get, the general government is to get a certain amount of land or a certain amount of money based on this apportionment. And the apportionment is including 3/5 for the slaves. And, you know, so he kind of spells this all out. So first off, what's really important is that that 3/5 rule, because the Constitution didn't say it, that 3/5 rule was a slave. And so Bottom line is at the very end, he talks about should be apportioned according to the surveyed land and improvements thereon in the several states. So in other words, when the federal government has money, that they, you know, based on the Confederation, they were to be able to apply that money equally so that the states could benefit. Well, in the new federal, because he's talking here in according to the Confederation. He's also talking about the general taxation and the general welfare. And then according to the Federation, he's basically saying that they had this ability to do, you know, apply this money based on the apportionment back out to the states. But the problem was that the returns, in other words, the money that was coming from the states was imperfect because they weren't paying their fair share. So that the Confederation couldn't actually do some of the things designed in it to help, you know, assist the development of the states. The interesting thing that they actually got rid of with the Constitution was the ability to do such developments. In essence, in the Articles of Confederation, it was kind of a general power, but it was hinged upon everybody, you know, honoring the rule of law and abiding by it. And the tragedy of commons snuck in because nobody was actually honoring the rule of law. Everybody was quickly going out in the middle of the night harvesting, if you understand the tragedy of commons. But okay. What they were doing was they were taking advantage of the system. They were gaming the system and trying not to pay their fair share, but get more from the till, or get more from the trough of government than they should have been getting. In other words, get more for yourself, but not, you know, contribute. In other words, being gluttonous or greedy. In other words, behaving badly. And that was the problem with the Confederation. And that was basically the whole point of, you know, why the Confederation failed. But the headline welfare may not real, this really is not necessarily welfare, but it is talking about the concept of the general welfare clause. The federal government, based on its powers, you know, in providing national security and those types of things, that is the general welfare that they're empowered to provide. They can't provide general welfare to something that they have not got the enumerated power. So when it came down to highway improvements, and they came to Madison to say, we want to do some highway improvements in the states, and we have this money that we want to apply to this, Madison said, you can't do it. That power is not delegated to the federal government. In other words, in this new constitution, they didn't have a general power that the Articles of Confederation actually had.
Okay.
In other words, they enumerated the United States Constitution. They defined it much better, and they contained the powers much better than the Articles of Confederation.
Okay.
So jumping down even further, because we really jumped down a ways, and we go down to, again, Rufus King, it's a note on January 21st, and so it's kind of highlighted. This is just a note. It's in blue, so go ahead and just go ahead and read this.
Okay, let me find it. What page is it on?
This is on page 41.
Oh, January 21st. That's okay. I found it. The Honorable Mr. King, you said page 41, right?
41, yep. It's the blue highlighted part.
There it is. We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which that government should be clothed. The introduction to this Constitution is in these words, we the people, etc. The language of the Confederation is we the states, etc. The latter is a mere federal government of states. Those, therefore, that assemble under it have no power to make laws to apply to the individuals of the states confederated. And the attempts to make laws for collective societies necessarily leave a discretion to comply with them or not. In no instance has there been so frequent deviation from first principles as in the neglect or refusal to comply with the requisitions of general government for the collection of monies.
Right. Okay. So one of the things that he's pointing out is that there was a difference between the Articles of Confederation in identifying that we the states and then we the people. Mm-hmm. And so what they did, the reason why they, because you know the style change, right?
Tell me what you mean.
So well, the sure. United States Constitution, it didn't actually say when they passed it, it didn't actually say we the people. It said something different, and it went
it
to
said,
a style
we the people
of
I'm
the
sorry, go ahead.
It said we the people of the state of Georgia and we the people right. of the state of, and they actually went through what I'll basically say, they went through these things called the enumeration of the states. So all 13 states were identified in, you know, the Constitution as parties to it. In other words, okay. we the people of all 13 states. And the Style Committee had two problems with it. It was okay. excessively long, you know, for a long preamble. And the question was, what if one state chose not to ratify? Ah.
Right.
Now what do you do?
Okay.
And so were they going to have to amend the Constitution to get rid of it? So they thought it would be by simplifying it. But the fact of the matter is the Constitution was not ever in the consideration of a body or a government of the people. The parties to it, as Madison stated, were the states. And it's the same thing here. He talks about that the societies, it is the states that have to pay the taxes. They're not going straight to the people. Mm-hmm. The taxes were based on apportionment and were levied to each of the states. So the interface right. or the parties to the compact are the states, and the interface to the federal government was with the states, not with the people. The people may have had their own representation in Congress, but they, you know, so did the states because they recognized the sovereignty of both. That's why we had bicameral legislative bodies. That's why every state had a bicameral legislative body. The only reason Nebraska got rid of its bicameral legislative body was because of the 17th Amendment. They said, hey, you know, if we're not going to represent the counties anymore, because the 17th Amendment is basically making everybody a democracy, then we're going to get rid of this stupid concept of bicameralism. Because why? The people are choosing their representation.
I wondered what their reason for that was.
Right.
Okay.
All righty. So
the 17th Amendment drove that decision.
For Nebraska, yes. It was post 17th Amendment. That's when they came along with this epiphany. Oh, well, shoot. You know, we need to adhere to, you know, this whole concept of the people are selecting, so why not have a unicameral legislative body? Well, we're out of time, and you don't know that, Paul, but the music is playing, so we will have you back in our next episode, and we'll dive more into the Massachusetts debates. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities,
responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.